whenever I tend to visit my family home, so where my mum lives is where I grew up, I always try to take at least one box of all the junk which I sort of left when I left home, which he is very patiently allowed to be dotted around in various corners, and then I go through it every so often. And this week, while I've been trying to clear my head, I've been sort of tidying up the shed and doing a bit of, you know, clearing out and that sort of thing, and deciding what needs to go in the recycling and what is actually of any material or sentimental value. And I came across this. This is not the... this is a Nokia, if you don't recognise it immediately, it's a Nokia 5110. It isn't the very first mobile phone I had. I think that... I've forgotten the model number. I think that was an even bigger brick with a much bigger aerial that used to be... I think my dad had it for work, and then my brother had it, and then I had it. I think that this is the first phone I ever owned from new. What does that tell us, apart from just triggering a bit of a nostalgic trip down memory lane? What can we say about this phone? Well, on the one hand, it couldn't be any more different, could it, from the smartphones that pretty much all of us have in our pockets, or at least carry around with us most of the time. It's far inferior in basically every single way. It's got much more limited capabilities and range and life and, you know, all those sorts of things. But on the other hand, it is still recognisable as a phone. I asked our not quite 2-year-old what this was, and straight away he said it was a phone, even though it was created at least 26 years before he was. And so even though it's been eclipsed in every way, it is still possible to kind of look at it and know what it is, and also to see how it kind of points forward to what we have now. And a similar kind of thing is true when we look, for example, in an Old Testament book like 2 Samuel of the kingdom of David. What we have here, what we've just read about, and David's kingdom of Israel way back when, that has been far eclipsed by the kingdom of Jesus. And yet, nevertheless, David's kingdom is a sort of a type or a prototype that points forwards to Christ's kingdom. And by looking at this, looking at David's kingdom, or rather God's kingdom as mediated through David, we are given, as it were, a pointer to what God's kingdom on earth looks like. We're not looking at the full expression of God's kingdom on earth. Of course, we're not. We're not even in that now. We're waiting for the second coming of Christ. But nevertheless, this picture that we see here, and in the next couple of chapters, it is in a sense a snapshot of what God's kingdom would look like. God's people are living in God's place, under God's anointed king, and experiencing the blessing of living under his rule. And in these chapters 8 to 10, King David's kingdom has reached its height, as it were. This is kind of the golden age. We're in a couple of chapters' time. As soon as we get to chapter 11, things are going to take a distinctive turn for the worst, and life for David and his people is never going to be quite the same. But I guess now perhaps let's just sort of enjoy the sunshine while it lasts and look at this golden age. And we're going to see three things. I've got three simple one-word or two-word headings that anticipate something of the greater fulfillment that is found in Jesus. Hence why, as a title, I've got Your Kingdom Come Down. This should, as it were, whet our appetites and yearn for the coming kingdom of Christ in all its fullness. Sadly, though, what we read of the historical account of David is that the surrounding nations were not actually joyful as they should have been to embrace God's king. Far from it. Most of them became, through their own volition, his sworn enemies, and could only be brought into God's kingdom through subjection and conquest. Which leads us to our first heading, which is simply victory. Or perhaps better, I should have put conquest, because this is not the sort of, you know, a victory of a football team over another, or a victory in a legal battle, but very clearly an overwhelming military victory, or many of them. There are two key words or key phrases in this section, verses 1 to 7 and 13 to 14. The first is I think it's a single word in the original, but it's translated as to defeat, to smite, or to strike down, which comes no less than seven times in the first 14 verses. Very clearly, the main theme of chapter 8 is David victoriously squashing and putting down his enemies. And if you were to plot his victories on a map, you also realise it's kind of an incredible feat of logistics as well. I think the enemy is kind of in approximately the right order as we read them. They're in the west, the south, the north, and the east. So you get the Philistines, verse 1, Moab, verse 2, Zobah, verse 3, the Syrians, verse 5, and then the Edomites down in verse 13. And so on the one hand, it's all about what David did, or what his armies and he did. So for example, verse 13 says, "And David made a name for himself." He is the active one, he's the one smiting all his foes. But the second key phrase, which comes up twice, puts what David did in perspective. So it comes twice, identical wording near the end of verse 6 and verse 14, where it says, by way of summary, "And the Lord," or Yahweh, "and the Lord gave victory to David wherever he went." And the Lord gave victory to David wherever he went. Now, we need to know that for two reasons. Firstly, simply so that we know who ought to get all the glory. God always should get all the glory for what he does, even when he does it through his servants. But also we need to know that it is God who gave David the victory, so that we would know that what we're reading about here is very different from any of the other sort of wannabe despots and dictators who have come and gone through the ages, including the time that he was alive, you know, in the sort of rise and fall of empire building. What we're reading, you know, when you read Joshua or what happens under Saul or David and so on, as they come into the land, it is kind of a one-off in history. God is, you know, giving them the land that he has promised them. And at the same time, he's exercising his just judgment on the absolutely heinous evil sin of the nations, these pagan idolatrous nations involved in all manner of evil. And he's also, in many cases, there's an immense amount of patience, as it were. He waits, scripture says, until kind of their iniquities were full up, and then, only then, does he act. So this is very, as it were, unique. David is not just another warlord or despot. He is God's king, doing God's work in a very unique, historically, situation. The reason I sort of emphasise that is sort of twofold in terms of getting our perspective right. I think whenever we come across, you know, in the Old Testament, one of these pretty, to our sort of modern palates, quite almost distasteful records of a huge amount of conquest, and in some cases almost genocide, some people might call it, you can very easily sort of get the wrong end of the stick, as it were, or misinterpret it wrongly. I think probably for the last X number of decades, what we tend to do, what people tend to do, especially the sort of liberals inside and outside the church, is to sort of look at this with a sort of chronological snobbery, I guess you could call it. You sort of think, well, we're so sophisticated now, and we're looking back at them, and they were just some sort of, you know, primitive savages. We live in a more sophisticated time, and we sort of look back, and we sort of think, you know, this is all just, you know, totally wrong and barbaric, which it isn't, because this is God's king, and in many cases fulfilling God's will directly. So I think that has probably historically, recently, been the bigger trend that needs correcting, and we need to emphasise that actually there are places where conquest and war is right. I wonder whether in recent times, and I'm not commenting deliberately on things that have happened in the last 6 weeks or so with war, but just generally in the politics, where now there seems to be the almost the opposite pendulum, where people identifying as Christian, but probably not actually as far as I can tell, they don't even know who Jesus is, barely, let alone have they repented and believed in him, sort of almost try and read this the opposite way, as though we just take things like this and we think, oh, well, we can do exactly the same thing and we can go and smite whoever we so feel like. We do not live in the same age of salvation history as David, do we? Our weapons, Ephesians tells us, are, you know, the sword of the spirit, the shield of faith, and so on. We don't fight against primarily physical enemies, but spiritual powers in a spiritual battle. And as we sometimes sing, you know, we are an army bold, but our battle cry is love. We wield a sword, but it's a sword that can make the wounded whole, and so on. So we do not live in the same age with the same sort of mandate. Nevertheless, in context, what David did is right, and we should, as it were, rejoice in the victorious conquest of God's anointed king over his enemies. As we've been reminding ourselves when we think of the Lord Jesus in Ephesians, God's eternal plan, Ephesians 1:10 says, is to reconcile all things to himself in and under Christ, with Christ as head. But that doesn't mean every single person in creation is going to be reconciled to Christ, as it were, with a warm embrace and a smiley face. It includes both those who willingly bow the knee to Christ and are wonderful recipients of his grace and joyful, willing, obedient servants, as well as those who oppose Christ to the end and will be pacified and defeated as he conquers. Every knee will bow and every tongue will confess that Christ is Lord. And as we often have cause to say, many of those will be through gritted teeth. Christ will conquer. He's already conquered in a very unusual, upside-down sort of way through the cross and resurrection, hasn't he? He conquered death, sin and Satan by giving up his very own life on the cross, and yet he is coming back to win a very different type of victory as his kingdom comes. It's all very, as we read both in Psalm 2, which I guess speaks firstly of David, and then beyond him to Christ. Why do the nations rage and the peoples plot in vain, as we've sung? The kings of the earth set themselves and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us burst their bonds apart and cast away their cords from us. He who sits in the heavens laughs. The Lord holds them in derision. Then he will speak to them in his wrath and terrify them in their fury, saying, as for me, I have set my king on Zion, my holy hill. Indeed, it's all very 1 Samuel 2, isn't it? Now remember Hannah's prayer, verse 10, the adversaries of the Lord shall be broken to pieces. Against them he will thunder in heaven. The Lord will judge the ends of the earth. He will give strength to his king and exalt the power of his anointed. So we see victory, a mighty victory. And God is even now fulfilling his great promises that he made to David, that was similar, sort of an elaboration of those that he had already made to Abraham and Moses. David's name, we read verse 13, has become great, exactly as God promised he would make him a great name. The nation has now been securely planted and established in the land, just as God promised, and they're being given rest from their enemies on all sides, just as God promised. And so in that sense, the coming of David's kingdom is the coming of God's kingdom, even though it is not the final fulfillment of it. So victory. Secondly, we see tribute, tribute in verses 7 through 12. Now, quite a lot of my favourite books, I'm not ashamed to admit, are picture books. Not all of them are the kids' books that I read to my boys, although some of them, to be fair, are pretty good. They're pretty high up on the list. But one of my favourite sort of picture books, if I can call it that, that I'm very pleased to have got hold of a few years ago for a very cheap price is a copy, it's a facsimile of the original catalogue from the Great Exhibition, you know, that Victoria and Albert put on back in the Crystal Palace when it was opened. And it's all, well, it, I was going to say it's photographs, but it's not. It must be etchings, black and white sort of, but almost photoreal line drawings of all the different treasures, the examples of great craftsmanship from, you know, all around the, well, the empire, I guess, including you know, a good deal from my own city of Sheffield, all the Sheffield steel and so on. And I really, you know, I wish if I could have any sort of nostalgic wish come true, I wish I could have sort of been alive to see it or somehow go back and be there at the Great Exhibition. Well, these few verses that we read, verses 7 through 12, are kind of like that. They're a catalogue of the treasures that have found their way into the possession of the king through, in this case, military conquest and subjection, except, I guess, with less of the sort of problematic cultural overtones, or at least the complicated cultural overtones of empire building in our day. But as we've said, you know, this is no ordinary ruler. This is God's king, and these were not private wars fought for personal gain. This was God's representative administering God's righteous judgment against evil nations. And yet again, through it all this tribute comes in, and yet David shows his godly reverence, his humility and his obedience, and his just desire to honour God with all that he does. Verse 11 tells us that this huge pile of booty, the spoils of war, they don't find its way into David's own back pocket in any way. He does not feather his nest. Instead, it says, these articles of silver and gold, King David dedicated to the Lord, together with the silver and gold that he dedicated from all the nations he subdued. So he set aside the vast amount of this wealth, the very best of it, for God's service. This might even mean when he started sort of stockpiling resources for the temple to be built in the future. And it's a pretty bold, isn't it? It's not an insignificant statement of God's lordship over him, that he would, as it were, immediately take all that he is receiving and just pour it out, as it were, at the Lord's feet. It's rather like that picture, isn't it, of you know, the saints on the last day, that the crown that we're going to be given by Christ is going to be, you know, as one teacher puts it, you know, it's going to be on our heads for about a nanosecond before we cast it down at Jesus' feet in tribute. He gives us great riches and we give it all back to him. But we see one wonderful exception to the rule of enmity against God's king, which is the example of the wonderfully named Toi, king of Hamath, who we meet in verse 9. When he heard that David had defeated the whole army of Hadadezer, Toi, very wisely, I think you'll agree, sent his son Joram to King David to ask about his health and to bless him because he had fought against Hadadezer, his enemy. And Joram brought with him articles of silver, of gold, and of bronze. So this is, I guess, both a case of the enemy of my enemy is my friend. King David had beaten up and got rid of Toi's great enemy. But also, this was surely the only wise and expedient thing to do, wouldn't it, when confronted with the unstoppable victory of God's king, to voluntarily bow down before him and offer him tribute, the best of what we have. Which is, of course, what we should do, isn't it, when we read of the total unstoppable victory that Jesus will win on the last day over those who oppose him. And when we read of the great victory, as we remind ourselves that he won over death on this Easter Sunday, to give him all that we have, being both joyful givers of what we've physically got, but also laying our lives down before him. Victory, then tribute, and finally we see righteous rule. I should have just gone for righteousness if I was going for a one-word heading for each, but I thought this is a bit more accurate. Righteous rule in the last few verses, verse 15 to the end. Let me just read verse 15. Here's the the wonderful summary. This is the so what. This is what happened as a result. So David reigned over all Israel, and David administered justice and equity to all his people. Now, it doesn't explicitly say this, but I wonder whether all his people surely must now include the various people who he has taken mercifully and made his servants in the conquests of the first verses. No matter who you are in David's kingdom, if you are one of his citizens, he administered to them justice and equity. And this is exactly also what God said that it would happen. He'd already told David a number of times. He's not raising up David just purely for his own sake, for David's own sake, but for the sake of God's own people, whom David would be a shepherd or an under-shepherd of over the Lord's behalf, mediating Yahweh's kingly rule of justice, of equity and righteousness to all his people. How many rulers, how many kings, queens, presidents, prime ministers and governments down the rolling centuries could you use these words to describe that they administered justice and equity to all their people? I'm sure some have genuinely tried to do that, but who has actually done that? I think no one. And at least for this time, like I say, it is going to turn sour by the time we get to chapter 11, but at least for this brief, however long it was, spell, this golden age, that is what was true of David's rule. It's probably impossible, I think, to overstate how important it is for God's people to have a worthy leader who rules well, who rules faithfully in God's stead. What is the whole book of Samuel, both volumes 1 and 2 Samuel, what is it other than a kind of an extended essay on kingship? And what are the books of 1 and 2 Kings other than a kind of a chronicle of how utterly disastrous it is when when God's people have a leader who does what is evil in the sight of the Lord and turns away from him? It is just leads them to ruin. And how transformative, how wonderful it is when on the rare occasions they have a king who honours Yahweh and lives faithfully to do his will. You could even sort of broaden that out and say that the whole Old Testament is kind of asking that question. Where is the one who is capable of leading God's people, of representing them to God and God to them? You know, ever since the fall of Adam, the representative of head of humanity, that question has been asked, hasn't it? Who is the one who is worthy of ruling God's people, and what will his reign look like? Well, here, finally, as it were, if you were reading from the beginning of the Bible, we start to get a picture, don't we, of what the righteous reign of God's anointed king looks like. David is here, I think, shown as the ideal king, isn't he, who reflects God's righteous rule and leads his people into a golden age of rest. And for centuries to come, perhaps even now actually, the Jewish people will look back at this and think, you know, this was the glory days. If only we could get back there, hoping that perhaps they might see its like again. Well, my friends, isn't that the kingdom that we've already tasted? If we have come into a living relationship with Jesus Christ through repentance and faith, you know, what is it that we're remembering this Easter Sunday but the victory of Christ over sin and death and Satan? And we know that with Jesus Christ, there's going to be no Bathsheba moment. There's no trace of sin in him, no fall from grace, no, as it were, wobbles in his faithfulness to God. He was truly, perfectly obedient to his Father, and now he is ever more alive, reigning righteously, and one day is going to come again to usher in an eternal kingdom of perfect equity, justice, and righteousness for all his people. Just want to finish by asking you the question, well, have you tasted, as it were? Have you realised the great blessing of living under Christ's righteous rule, even in this lifetime, while longing for the perfect, total consummation of it in the life to come? Because we will one day, won't we, if we are his, with resurrected, glorified bodies and glorified minds, glorify our risen King and enjoy him forevermore. And I don't know about you, but I can't wait for that day.